But first up, we turn to the world's financial system, which is in crisis rescue mode. What caused the problem? Is the proposed rescue package a good idea? And what will happen next?
To examine these fundamental questions, we are now joined by John Roskam, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Affairs in Melbourne, and in our Sydney studio, Dr. Stephen Kirshner, a research fellow at the Sydney-based Centre for Independent Studies. Both the CIS and the IPA are pro-free market think tanks. John Roskam, welcome to Counterpoint.
Hello, Paul.
And welcome, Stephen.
Hi.
Stephen Kirshner, how did we get into this mess?
Very good question. I think this will be one that the economic historians will puzzle over in the same way that they still puzzle over the origins of the Great Depression. But essentially the problem is that the US housing market ended up being oversupplied. And a lot of the structured debt products that we use to finance that oversupply were mispriced in financial markets.
Going around the internet over the last 72 hours has been an article from the New York Times, September 1999, and the headline is Fannie Mae eases credit to aid mortgage lending. And the writer said Fannie Mae is taking on significantly more risk and they may run into trouble in an economic downturn. A lot of people are talking about that, but why was Fannie Mae encouraged to take on more debt?
Historically, there's been a strong emphasis on the part of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on supporting low-income people into housing. And by the time we got to 2006-2007, the congressional mandate for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac saw them get heavily involved into subprime lending. And in fact, they became the biggest buyers of subprime debt in 2006-2007. So I think in many ways, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, with their congressional mandate to support low-income housing, bear a large part of the responsibility both for the oversupply of the US housing market and the subsequent problems in credit markets.
This puts the debate in an interesting light. There are those who say it's the market's fault. You're suggesting that perhaps congressional mandates about who you should be lending money to for real estate actually is a root cause of the problem we're in now.
It's part of it. I mean, people have this mistaken impression that financial markets are somehow this unregulated free-for-all, and that's not the case. They're actually very heavily regulated, more heavily regulated than markets for goods and services. In the US, there's probably about 160 different regulators involved in the financial system. And so to the extent that we have problems today, this is by implication a failure of regulation.
John Roskam, what about your opinion on this? Are we seeing a failure of capitalism or a failure of government here?
Well, I hope it's not a failure of capitalism yet, quite, Michael. But as Stephen was indicating, what we saw in the 1980s was the Clinton administration in the US encouraging banks to lend to people on low incomes. And when you had interest rates at 1%, you could do that. And the banks were not too concerned about whether the borrowers had income or whether they had jobs. And certainly the government said, don't be concerned, because they wanted to expand home ownership beyond the traditional white Anglo-Saxon province. And so what we have now are some of the consequences of that. So when we look at whether the system has failed because of regulation or too much regulation, we have to look at, well, regulation caused a lot of these problems in the first place, and now we're hoping that regulation will get us out of those problems, and I'm not quite convinced.
And it was regulation done in the interests of what were socially admirable aims, perhaps?
Well, exactly. I mean, it is definitely socially admirable, and it is a benefit for society and families and individuals to own your own home. I mean, that is the best form of social security you can get. But if banks are lending to people who can't afford to pay back, and if banks are lending at 1% interest rates, perhaps in the knowledge that in the American terminology, those interest rates will reset, or in Australian terminology, they'll be variable and the interest rates will go up, then we have problems. And so we have a real issue. We have a socially admirable aim of getting low-income earners into their own homes. But the consequences of that are a lot of people were lent money that they couldn't afford. So, you know, to some extent, the banks are in a difficult spot. If they don't lend to people on low incomes, they'll be accused of discriminating against blacks and Hispanics. But if they do lend to people on low incomes, then they'll be accused of being predatory. And that's exactly what's happened in the United States. On the one hand, you have the Democrats in the 80s encouraging banks to do this. And now the Democrats are saying, well, banks are predatory and banks are nasty and banks are profit gouging. So, you know, we have to accept that, you know, ultimately the banks and the financial institutions are at the province of the regulators.
Stephen Kirshner, we got into this mess partly by government mandates about how housing finance should be distributed. We've got a rescue package. Details are still being worked out, but we've got a rescue package that's worth, what, close to $1 trillion Australian dollars. Is it necessary?
I don't think it is. I think in many ways what the feds in the US are doing is crowding out private capital, which would be willing to step up to the plate and buy some of these distressed assets if the federal government wasn't hanging around. And in a way, we know it's unnecessary because when Lehman got into trouble and the feds failed to support it, private buyers did emerge. So Lehman's assets are now being bought up by Barclays and Nomura. And so in many ways, I think that the bailout is about Wall Street thinking probably correctly that they can get a better deal from the feds than they can get in the marketplace.
Let's follow the logic of that through. You're saying a bit of creative destruction should go on here?
Yes, I think so. At the very least, they should be intervening at a different point. Alan Meltzer, one of the economists in the US, has argued that if they're going to intervene, they should do it after the institutions have failed. So let them fail, wipe out the shareholders, then you don't get moral hazard problems, and only then do you step in and buy up the distressed assets.
Well, Stephen, why is the government doing this? I can see what's in it for the private sector, but what's in it for government?
Well, interestingly enough, the US government could actually make a profit out of this, despite all the numbers that are being bandied about. Because what they'll do is they'll buy up the distressed assets from US financial institutions at distressed prices, hopefully, and they will hold those assets until maturity. And subsequently, they will sell those assets, and presumably at a higher price when things have settled down.
That's
so they may actually turn a profit on this. I mean, there's a precedent for this in terms of the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was set up to buy up the assets of the savings and loan industry that got into trouble in the early 1990s. Okay. And so the RTC eventually turned a profit.
John Roskin, can I ask, what's your view of the rescue package?
Well, firstly, Michael, I'm not sure whether it's the business of government to be making money out of distressed mortgages that they're buying. So we have the broad issue of, well, you know, maybe the taxpayer won't get slugged quite as much, and maybe the government might make a profit. But, you know, for someone who believes that government's about the police force and the army and protecting private property, we have that first issue. But, you know, I think Stephen's right. In an ideal world, you wouldn't have the necessary bailout as we've seen. But the problem that we've seen is the lack of confidence. And so we now have the situation whereby if the government hadn't done something, then the markets would have fallen even further, perhaps plummeted, and as the saying goes, that Wall Street would have started affecting Main Street. So in an ideal world, you wouldn't have it, but perhaps the bailout is the least bad option. But when we have people expecting the government to do things, and when we have a Republican administration that's nominally free market and small government and supporting less taxes doing this, we know we have a real problem. But this is how bad the situation has become.
Well, do we have any objective, I mean, what's the evidence for that, for saying that that absent this $700 billion US, things would collapse?
Oh, look, you're right, Michael, there's absolutely no evidence. And, you know, this is the thing that, you know, the fundamentals of the world economy are still strong, and the fundamentals of the Australian and US economies are quite strong. But the feeling certainly in Washington was that another stock market plunge would have affected the financial system to such an extent that the credit crunch would have continued. So, you know, we are dealing in hypotheticals, and certainly you'll be talking about computer modelling later on. You know, we're dealing with models about credit crunches and such things, and what computers can predict. So, you know, certainly we don't know, but the level of uncertainty was such that perhaps, you know, this was necessary. But the problem is that it is highly unlikely this will be the end of it. You know, you can probably think of $1 trillion and double it or perhaps triple it, which is what people are now talking about. This won't be the end of it. And you're now going to have a massive expansion in the role of the US government, of US regulators, and we are years away. And, you know, we're talking about bailout packages today. We might be having this conversation every couple of months, the rate we're going.
Well, Stephen, you've clearly got a different view. What would be some of your reasoning to say that, in fact, we're not facing that loss of confidence?
Well, I think in many ways the US administration was just trying to frighten Congress into passing it by using a lot of overblown rhetoric. I mean, we have a very good historical precedent here, which is the Great Depression. And there's a lot of scholarship now coming out, especially Amity Schley's book, The Forgotten Man, which is sort of a revisionist history of the Great Depression. And I think she shows quite conclusively that government intervention both deepened and prolonged the Great Depression, and that if markets had been allowed to function, the depression would have been short and sharp. And in fact, this was the experience of the recession before that in 1920 and 21, which was very nasty in some ways, but it was over very quickly.
We always have that problem, don't we, that economics is a social science. It's not quite as firm.
Yes.
It's not quite
it's
as...
It's all about emotion.
Well, it's not quite as firm and as hard as physics. I mean, Amity Schley's hypothesis may well be correct, but I was taken by George W. Bush's comment over the weekend. Hey, folks are saying, I thought he was a market sort of guy, he being George W. Bush, and he said, but when I looked at the size of the problem, .. John Roskam, you're saying we might have this conversation every couple of months. What about in Australia? Are we shielded a bit from the American problem, or is this one in, all in?
Well, I think it's one in, all in. I mean, the great debate has been to what extent has, as the saying goes, Australia decoupled from the US. And the question is not whether Australia has decoupled, but has China and India decoupled? And again, we're dealing with an issue of confidence, because of course we have to remember that the China boom is what has underwritten Australia's great middle class binge, whether it's middle class debt binge, whether it's middle class government welfare binge, and the question is to what extent can this continue? So, you know, we're already seeing it now that the stock market pretty much goes up and down in relation to how the Dow Jones goes overnight. We are all passionately interested in the bailout situation. We're seeing the credit market here starting to seize up. Apparently, we've got the Australian government doing something very similar to what the US government is doing. So, you know, I think we'll be pretty much moving in lockstep for some time to come. But that said, Australian banks are better run than in the US. Our subprime credit books are much smaller than in the US. You know, and certainly we might not be facing the very, very hard landing of
John,
the
just a very quick follow-up on that. The figure I saw today was that the subprime market in Australia is about 1%. So in some ways we're protected.
Look, so we're certainly better off, but it could still be very, very difficult.
We're almost out of time, but if I could just ask you both the same fairly quick question. Now, you both represent organisations that are, I think, in general opposed to too much government regulation. Is it possible at this point to say anything about the lessons that this suggests to us about the role of government regulation in the economy? Starting with you, Stephen.
Well, I think the big lesson here is that the issue is not do we need more regulation. I think if there's an issue around regulation, it's the quality of that regulation, which may actually involve less regulation, so actually more streamlined regulation. So the focus should be on regulatory quality, I think, rather than the notion that we just need more of what we've already got.
Okay. John Roskam.
No, I think that's right. But remember, politics trumps everything. And in a foxhole, when you're getting shot at and there are bombs going off everywhere, there are very few atheists. So similarly, there are very few marketeers in a credit crunch.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much to both of you, John and Stephen. John Roskam is the Executive Director of the Institute for Public Affairs in Melbourne, and Stephen Kirshner is a Research Fellow at Sydney's Centre for Independent Studies.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National. on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.